I just want to make a couple of very brief comments, hopefully, so I'm going to be paying attention to the time. We've been talking a lot about what the gravity path integral can tell us about black hole information, and we've been talking about how it seems to give answers which look like answers given by an ensemble of quantum theories instead of a single quantum theory. And so that obviously raises a lot of questions. And I want to start by making a separation of all these questions into sort of two categories. I think it's a little bit useful to think about these two categories. The first class of questions is what can the gravity path integral tell us about specific members of an ensemble? So we have examples where gravity path integral is actually genuinely described in theories. JT gravity would be an example of that. Can the gravity path integral tell us anything about one member of this ensemble? And the other question, which I think is a little bit more disturbing, is what can it tell us about theories which we don't think are members of an ensemble? So an example of this would be n equals 4 super Yang mills. So
these lower things, these are boundary theories by definition?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to start by looking at this left class of questions. And I want to further separate questions about specific members of the ensemble into two categories. And I think these terms are useful. They came up a lot yesterday. And I want to say this so we have this terminology in mind going forward. So the terminology I want to introduce is the notion of self-averaging or not self-averaging. So what it means is pretty obvious. If you have an ensemble, and you take one member of this ensemble and you ask a question, you calculate some quantity, whether or not it's self-averaging is whether or not the value of this quantity for a single member of the ensemble is well approximated by the average of the ensemble. And so we've seen an example of this. A self-averaging quantity would be the entanglement entropy in its Page curve. A quantity which we don't expect to be self-averaging is something like the density matrix of a black hole. For a single member of the ensemble, if you set up a black hole in a pure state, let it evolve, let it radiate, you expect to have a pure density matrix. But then if you average that pure density matrix over some ensemble, generically the average of a pure density matrix is a mixed density matrix.
Does this require some adjustable parameter
becomes large? Yeah, so usually you think of a notion of a large number of degrees of freedom, and as you take the limit of you have many degrees of freedom, then this averaging works well. So this self-averaging means, say, you have a small sample or a larger sample, a larger sample, it approaches the average as you take the sample to be very large.
By self-averaging, you really mean of order the number of them. With corrections.
Yeah, the corrections.
Over the number.
Yeah, exactly, yes. So, also brought up yesterday was the idea that the S matrix, which is another important question in black hole information, the S matrix we don't expect to be self-averaging. The gravity path integral seems to be pretty good at giving us the answer for self-averaging quantities. It's an interesting question to ask. What can it tell us about non-self-averaging quantities like the S matrix? And I want to make a couple points about an example of this. Instead of the S matrix in ADS, we can consider transition amplitudes between black hole microstates. And the simplest of these would be, we start with the thermal field double state, we evolve it for some time, and we take the overlap with thermal field double state. I'm going to call this A of t. So this amplitude A of t, how does this thing behave? I'm going to plot its modulus squared. And I want to find some red chalk. So,
what's H there?
H is a Hamiltonian.
Of which Hamiltonian?
So, what I'm doing is I'm considering an ensemble of Hamiltonians, ensemble of theories, and I take one of them. And I'm going to draw what we imagine to be a representative picture for one element of this ensemble.
I think the question is, it H left plus H right, H left?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, this will do H right, for example. Yeah. So it'll look something like this. And this is basically just noise here. There's not much structure to it. So something like this, the details of this function here, this is exponentially small. If this is of order 1. The details of this is very complicated. It depends on the actual energy levels of the system. It's something that seems very difficult to get from something like a nice simple path integral. Is there any hope in trying to use the gravity path integral to learn things about quantities like this? Well, if we have an ensemble, then we can talk about the statistics of this noise. And the gravity path integral is very good at giving us all the statistics of this. As an example, if we tried to calculate the average of A of t as a nice simple shape, if we try to calculate the variance of this noise around the average, then it also has a simple answer. If we try to calculate something like the autocorrelation time, what's the correlation between the signal here and the signal there? We can also calculate that using the gravity path integral. So all these statistics of this very complicated non-self-averaging quantity are calculable using the gravity path integral. So now I want to ask, what can we learn about quantities like this in theories which are not members of an ensemble? So
before, can I ask maybe a naive question?
So yeah.
Whether the path integral was gravitational, does that play a role here? Because if we have a path integral for a chaotic billiards, can we still get this noise?
Yeah, so I just want to restrict this discussion just to gravity. So the fact that you get the statistics from the path integral has to do with the fact that it's gravity. So maybe just to illustrate that very simply, how would I calculate something like this in statistics? Well, A of t is just a path integral with one boundary. A of t modulus squared, I have two boundaries. So if I want to calculate the average, if I try to use the gravity path integral to calculate the modulus squared of A, I could fill I could put a geometry here which connects the two boundaries. But if I try to calculate something which is A of t modulus of the fourth, I now have four boundaries. And I get additional contributions from something like this. And so this is a feature you wouldn't see in something just like billiards where there's no averaging or anything like that. Does that answer your question?
Well, maybe. Like, I was asking if we try to do the path integral using sum over trajectories and things like that in a chaotic billiard, do we have an example where we get these wiggles like using that path integral in a chaotic?
Yes. If you try to calculate it numerically, you find the saddle points of the path integral numerically, you can see that you get a signal looking like this, but maybe I don't want to go into the billiard systems right now.
You get the moments.
You can get the moments using some approximations.
By some souped-up diagonal approximation.
Yeah, that's true,
So there is something sort of like that going on if you study averages of this chaotic thing.
But getting the actual noise on the nose analytically, you're not going to be able to do.
Right. Right, so that's the same whether we have gravity or not. The fact that we can't get the details of the noise.
Well, I disagree because in that case we have a principled calculation you could do to get the noise. You write down the path integral, it's supposed to give the answer. In gravity, we don't know how to write down a machine to give the answer. We just have this gravity path integral. Yeah.
So in the sort of spirit of discussion, how would you or anyone enunciate what is it about the gravitational path integral that allows you to do this more than any other path integral?
Allows me to get these statistics?
I mean, you emphasize that this works for gravitational path integral and not any other in response to
well,
so what is it about?
One thing is, I think, illustrated by this example. Say you try to calculate a of t squared, and then you square that, versus calculating a of t to the fourth. Well, the first thing here, I don't include this picture that I've drawn. I calculate a of t squared, forgetting about these two. And I'd square it, I just have two things like this. If I try to calculate this thing, I'd include geometries which connect these boundaries as well. So I get two times the, I get a contribution like this, and then the one I had before. So I get two times these pair of cylinders. So the gravity path integral gives us different answers for something like the fourth moment and for something to the fourth than something squared and then squared. So the reason the gravity path integral is doing something different is because it allows us to connect different boundaries. It looks like it's giving us correlation functions instead of specific quantities raised to some power. Yeah.
So have you finished explaining what all you can get from that? So I'm imagining there's really some huge non-Gaussian probability distribution that you could, if you wished, map out in this way.
Yeah.
And then you might ask, okay, what is the probability that the actual realization, the actual Hamiltonian, was such and such versus some other such and such? Is that the sort of thing you can get some information about here, or are you saying there's...
No, so...
Not at all? Like there's
So the problem is, what I want to emphasize is, if you want to ask about this one member of the ensemble, and I forgot I was part of an ensemble, and the statistics that I'm trying to calculate aren't very meaningful, obviously.
Why not? So, I mean, I'm just asking, like, if I give you very extreme different versions of this Hamiltonian, you have these parameters that you and David talked about.
Yes.
And I just want to ask, okay, is it more probable that the realization you dealt with was one of them or the other? Is that something you can answer? I mean, that's something we do in normal data analysis where we just have... You know, we have cosmic variance, and it's all...
Yeah. Yes, you could calculate something like that. I want to get to this, the next point I wanted to make, because I think it'll make what I'm saying a little bit more clear. So...
Well, generally, not every saddle point contributes to a path integral. So your evidence for the gravity describing the ensemble is...
Yeah, so some of these quantities, so not every saddle point contributes to the path integral. We don't know the rules very clearly. I'm going to tell you in a moment about a case where you have saddle points like this, and it gives you a physically sensible answer, and so we want to interpret it as something you should include in the path integral. So now I'm going to talk about something like this. Say we have one specific theory, and I try to calculate this amplitude. What do we make of this amplitude when we try to calculate it in gravity? So if we have n equals 4 super Yang Mills, I try to calculate this thing, and I think n equals 4 super Yang Mills is dual to string theory. I do the gravity path integral, and I find answers like this. I find answers that look like they're giving me statistics of this signal. How do I make sense of those things physically? Well, to do that, you can talk about a different sort of averaging. So we don't believe that n equals 4 super Yang Mills is part of an ensemble. But we can talk about statistics of this signal for n equals 4 meaningfully. What we can do is we can take this noisy signal average over time windows, and we find, and here I've averaged over some coarse time windows, and we find a signal which approaches some smooth function. So for a single theory that is not a member of the ensemble, we can also do some sort of averaging. We can do time averaging. That'll give us something which is not A of t modulus squared, but some average over time windows. This thing is given reliably by the path integral. And in fact, in this case, if I do something which is a little different than this, I change it from the thermal field double to something with fixed energy, then the gravity path integral for this thing is given by a genuine saddle point.
So the time window is a parameter, the size of the time window.
Yeah.
But how is that showing up in the gravitational path integral?
So would you say, how would you do this in gravity? I try to calculate A of t squared. I have a couple of boundaries, each for A of t. And then I integrate over my time window with some function of t. So I can calculate this in gravity, and then I take the integral of the gravity answer. And then it gives me something which does depend on the time window. So
if you don't do the integral, if you just calculate that in gravity,
yeah. That's a good question. So maybe I'll get to that in a second. So the thing I want to emphasize is that even when you're in a situation where you don't believe you have an ensemble to talk about, there's still a notion of the statistics of non-self-averaging quantities. I can talk about, instead of taking the time average of the square, taking the time average of the fourth moment, sixth moment, etc. And I get a bunch of quantities which seem to be reliably calculated by the gravity path integral. So, yeah, you have a question?
I mean, if you did that with the ensemble, but you pick single member of the ensemble, forget about the whole rest of the ensemble and do this time averaging,
yeah.
Would you get the same thing you get as for the ensemble average?
The words you could say is something like this time average is going to be a self-averaging quantity in the ensemble. So what is this telling us? Well, I guess the lesson I want to emphasize is that while the gravity path integral seems to be very... Yeah.
So when you start with the thermal field double and you fix the energy, you're also doing some integral over time to fix the energy, right? Is that different from...
I don't want to do an integral over time to fix the energy there.
Well,
I'd say maybe... do some sort of Laplace transform with respect to the temperature.
Isn't that also an integral over time? Because
I guess you can think of it that way, I suppose, yeah. It's not... sorry, what was the rest of your question then, maybe?
Well, I just wasn't clear in practice what the difference is between this integral over time and what you normally do to get the...
So in practice?
In your paper, you... You went to the microcanonical ensemble.
Yeah.
And that involved doing an integral over the boundary time, over the two times, with some Gaussians and so on. Maybe Euclidean time, but some integral over time. Isn't that more or less similar to doing this? But what is the difference between that and this integral over time that you're discussing?
So, maybe the thing I want to say about that is, what you expect if you didn't have any sort of averaging, if you took a quantity like this, but you took it in the microcanonical ensemble, you expect to get these large fluctuations. But if you do this thing that I'm talking about here, and you average over an appropriately large time window, you don't expect to get these fluctuations. So they're supposed to be giving you something that behaves very differently, even though I'm doing some sort of time integral in both cases.
Is it also true that it's that time integral happens in the definition of A rather than in the definition of these brackets? So the integral over beta that gives you the microcanonical version is in the variable A. It's not in the brackets. So you only do, you do as many of those integrals as you have copies of A.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So those things are supposed to factorize.
Mm-hmm.
whereas this thing is not, because you do the only the integral at the end.
But if we look at just one observable,
what are you doing? You're not doing average, and you don't get these graphs.
Then you shouldn't get them, but you do.
Yeah. So that's this last issue I want to emphasize. So the gravity path integral is pretty good at giving us a lot of things. You could characterize these things when you are in the context of an ensemble of theories by whether it's self-averaging or not self-averaging. When you don't have an ensemble to talk about, there's analogous quantities you can talk about that are you expect to be smooth, you expect them to have some sort of universal behavior. They roughly correspond to...
Sorry, what does universal mean if you just have one boundary?
So I want to be really, really non-specific about what I mean, but in this case, yeah. It's in practice. Take a quantity which you think is self-averaging here. Say I can calculate some entanglement entropy. I can calculate one of these time-averaged quantities. And I think I have a pretty similar seeming system here that looks like that. Then I'll just calculate the same quantity in this system. That's all I mean by it. I don't want to give a very sharp...
You're imagining, therefore, that in the N equals 4 case, there is another... Actually,
no, what I want to say is this is quantities like this are self-averaging in ensembles of theory described by the gravitational path integral. How do we make sense of the analogous gravitational path integral that we think describes theories like N equals 4, which is not an ensemble? We think it's giving the right answer for these same questions that were self-averaging in the ensemble, but self-averaging doesn't mean anything outside of the ensemble, but questions like this that translate to self-averaging questions.
The gravitational might be just the gravitational. The string theory...
Sure. The string theory might give you something which has the curve, the red curve here.
I have a question. Can this be written in any sensible way to the Eigenstate normalization hypothesis, where we believe that some things are self-averaging?
Yeah, so the gravity path integral knows about the Eigenstate thermalization hypothesis because questions related to smooth statistics of the eigenvectors. If you're asking about a question like that in context of an ensemble, you can produce questions which are self-averaging about the statistics of the eigenvectors. The path integral knows about those things. And the path integral will tell you the answers to analogous questions outside of an ensemble. Yeah, Rafael.
So you discussed two ways of averaging. In the case where you have an ensemble, you can either average over the ensemble or you can average over time. But only the second one sort of generalizes to the case where you don't have an ensemble.
Yeah.
And you're basically conjecturing that in that case, that's what the gravity path integral is still going to compute.
What I'm going to say is that there's many examples where we are pretty sure it's giving the right answer. So these moments here, there's some reasons we think gravity path integral is pretty good at getting you the right answer. Maybe I'd say it seems likely possible. I don't want to say anything.
I have two questions about that. One is whether I should really think of this time averaging as your definition of self-averaging. Some theory is self-averaging if that time average agrees with the ensemble average. Is that your definition of self-averaging?
No. So I really don't want to take this time average. There's all sorts of averaging you can do. Time average is an example. It's very difficult.
A very basic point, which is as soon as you draw that cross graph, it seems to me you automatically have an ensemble, period,
yeah.
End of
story.
So if you're going to do any calculation in which that cross graph plays any role, you have an ensemble.
So maybe let me finish what I was about to say, and then, okay, so how do we make sense of the actual answers for theories which are not given by an ensemble? The last comment I want to make is... maybe related to what Raphael was saying yesterday, which is that it seems like we're being forced into having the gravity path integral describe an ensemble. Do we think we can do anything to maybe modify the gravity path integral so that it's not describing an ensemble? We believe that hopefully in this case there should be something like that we can do. I'm not going to answer that question, but I will say that the things that I'm talking about are consistent with there being corrections to quantities like this. So say I'm trying to calculate something like this, and I know the full string theory, path integral, whatever. Maybe I have additional contributions in addition to this, which make it factorized instead of not factorized. What do we know about those corrections? Well, in quantities that correspond to self-averaging quantities, those corrections should be small. They'll be large in the case of something that isn't self-averaging, if you ask about a specific question like this. So I think the point is that this gravity path integral can tell us a lot about, we believe the gravity path integral is telling us a lot about even theories which are not self-averaging, which are not members of an ensemble, if you ask the right questions. So all these things with wormholes and connecting different asymptotic boundaries, everything like that, we should take the answers we're getting from those pretty seriously, but we have to ask the right questions. Even if you try to ask something about something which is like completely not self-averaging, one of these amplitudes is very crazy, the actual answer knows about the specific values of the energy levels of the system, you can still produce meaningful, you can still learn meaningful things about something like this outside of the context of an ensemble from the gravity path integral. And so therefore, I think this is probably some hint in the direction that the gravity path integral, if we have to modify it to understand something beyond the ensemble, then it may not be so dramatically different from what we're seeing from the naive gravity path integral.
So I just want to make a really brief comment on that point that you raised. So I understood from what you said, what something Douglas said last night, that the hope is that, let's call it, string theory comes and cancels the bad stuff but leaves you with the good stuff, roughly speaking. Right? Yeah. it's an open possibility. I appreciate the possibility. I just want to stress that there are some situations where string theory itself does the analog of the Euclidean quantum gravity things. Situations like that even apply in black hole physics. The examples I know are more in the context of singularities. But for example, there's Euclidean quantum gravity effects that accomplish topology change, like the Witten bubble. Mm-hmm. And then in another regime of parameters, there's a classical stringy effect that does the same thing. Okay, so it could be that, it's hilarious to me because I think this discussion is glass half empty versus half full when it comes to gravity versus string theory. It could be that the string theory does the thing you want when it dominates, and the Euclidean gravity Planckian stuff is then beside the point. And we do know examples like that. It doesn't mean we didn't learn from the gravity analysis. It means that there's some more prosaic dynamics that is available in string theory that does something similar. So I just want to put that on the table. And final comment is, in these large radius gravity systems, there's a very, very special property, which is that there are these scales. There's not a desert. There are these other scales that appear way before you get to the Planckian regime. And in some sense, due diligence requires first things first. We analyze what those things do. So it's not, this is beautiful, but I think it's a leap to say that the Euclidean gravity stuff is the lesson that will always be the dominant effect, even if it, suggests the type of effect that is needed. It might come from other sources.
Yeah. What you're saying sounds a lot like what we usually call ergodicity, right?
Mm-hmm.
How is it different?
I think you could basically say this is the same thing. I could give you some examples where I think basically these things I'm talking about come down to saying, I assume, ergodicity. Maybe I'll ask you about that later.
So in doing the time averaging, are you still able to use the Euclidean path integral, or do you now need to start talking about the Lorentz?
Oh, well, okay. I should... I'm doing the Lorentzian and Euclidean path integral. So, but yes, yes.
But don't we think that the
I'm going to call the gravity path integral just to be more general.
Don't we think the Euclidean path integral somehow is smarter than the Lorentzian path integral and knows more? And so, should we worry that if we do a time averaging, we'd be losing some information?
I'm not sure, but for questions like this, we're getting very sensible-looking answers, and so I think there's still something serious you could say. I think you should take this Lorentzian version of this path integral somewhat seriously. It's giving us really sensible-looking answers.
Yeah. So I wanted to clarify something first before asking my question. Am I understanding correctly that the 1-9-1 entropy is supposed to be self and time averaging?
Yeah. So if you average over small time window, it's obviously going to approach itself. Yeah.
Was there a prior reason that would have been the case from field theory without knowing about the gravity path integral? It's a question of purity. How would you know that something is pure a priori without... I mean, if you didn't know the Euclidean path integral, would we have said that the 1-9-1 entropy was time averaging in quantum field theories?
I guess I'm not really sure the answer to that question. Maybe the...
And the entropy is summing over many states, right?
Yeah, so...
Since it's doing some average.
In the very explicitly, maybe in the examples Zhenmin talked about the other day, the entropy comes from summing over... You have the quantities which are not self-averaging. There are these overlaps between states. But the entropy comes from a sum over a large number of those things. So we might expect in general something similar happens. You have a bunch of overlap between states which aren't self-averaging, but it seems reasonable to expect the sum does. It's self-averaging.
Thank you.
I just want to clarify something which I think I heard. I mean, this is Ivo was alluding to this. People who are now suggesting that the gravitational path integral describes an ensemble, do they question original ADS-CFT with n equals 4 super Yang-Mills as being an exact duality? Or are they simply saying that if you ignore all the massive modes and just look at the low energy gravitational degrees of freedom, you're somehow describing an ensemble?
Well, I don't know what people are saying exactly. Just people are saying a lot of things, but... I think there's possibilities for what could be the case.
So there are questioning the original.
I think maybe some of the
there's a lot of evidence for it. Yeah. I mean, do we have to check all the 10,000 or maybe 15,000 papers?
Gary, I don't
probably after what Don and Henry are going to say, maybe it'll be even more of a interesting question to say. Oh, is there actually something like an ensemble of higher dimensional gravity theories? But I don't know. Some people I've talked to just think that we need to figure out what are the corrections of this thing. In some cases, they may fully cancel all these non-factorizing things and give you answers which don't look like an ensemble. That seems. And in fact, there's explicit examples of non-gravitational theories, simple chaotic theories that have similar properties like these, where things work in a much more conventional way. So it depends who you ask, I guess.
Can I ask Gary to clarify what he meant by an exact duality? I don't understand how...
Well, gravitational side was only known perturbatively.
Yeah.
And so the duality said that, yes, if you do the perturbative expansion in the super Yang-Mills side, you get the same answers as the perturbative expansion we know in the gravity side from the string theory.
Yeah.
That's all we knew. And then the other side gave us another...
But another way of saying that is that the super Yang-Mills side is a non-perturbative completion of the gravity side.
Sure.
And so in that sense, there was never an equivalence between the two sides.
But I think what Gary is saying is not that there is an equivalence, but it's not clear what the ensemble is.
Yeah. No, I completely agree that it's not clear what the ensemble is, but that doesn't mean that... So we can simply say that the gravity path integral, you know, does the best it can to approximate quantities in super Yang-Mills. But it wasn't required to get them all on the nose. It depends which questions you ask.
You are saying holographic is not holographic, but the photographic? But I think the point is that there are some calculations you can do with the path integral that give answers which look like they can only be interpreted as an ensemble. That seems to be the.
But those aren't under control yet, correct? Right? I mean, those aren't under control in the type 2B on S5 with F1.
Well, I mean, the double cone that Phil and friends discussed, I don't know, it seems to be well defined. So.
But it might not be the leading effect, right? I mean, I thought that's what Phil was suggesting as well.
It might be the leading effect, but the wiggles are of the same size, so. There should be a correction of the same size.
Yeah, but it seems important that the regime in which these sort of things happen, where there are some answers which can only be interpreted in terms of an ensemble, is also one in which you could easily get some completely wrong answers from the gravity path integral. I mean, in a situation where you have, you know, you're way past the page time in a black hole, or you have a larger number of states in the area of some horizon. I mean, that's the setting in which we're exploring here, which was not part of the first 15,000 papers. And that's where, you know, we have to be careful, I think, in a new way about how to think about what the gravitational path integral is telling us.
Yeah, can I ask both Juan and Phil to clarify, because I really had thought the statement was that there's room for other effects that do compete with this crossed diagram.
There's no room naively in the maybe after what Henry and Don are going to say, maybe this I could say more, but
I mean, in any case,
to get something like this from a path integral calculation, we have no idea what.
It's not all about this Euclidean gravity path integral. There's a huge amount more in the theory than that. And I thought, in fact, that's what you yourself were saying when you said it might cancel that.
Yeah, I think there's no indication that anything conventional that we know from string theory would be enough to.
Well, it's a question. It has to be computed, right? I mean.
Yeah, I guess maybe to be a little bit more explicit, if you try to do this calculation, and you can ask, what happens if I include. What would you think would happen if I included. So this is a pure gravity calculation I might try to do first. And then I might say, what happens if I add matter fields? Do those give some sort of small fluctuations? If I add lots of matter fields, does it give larger fluctuations? If I try to do string theory on a background like this, does it give some sort of instability that indicates this large noisy signal? Well, and there's no hint of anything like that.
Well, I disagree with that. String theory is a very non-local theory. There are hints that that makes quite a large difference, one that can't be accounted for by just a trivial sum over alpha prime effects or field theory propagators. So certainly nobody is claiming victory on that in that direction, but to say that there's no hint of it or there's no possibility of it is a much
stronger. I'm not saying that there's no possibility. I guess that there's no obvious hint of like a clear direction. It's surely a possibility, yes.
Other point of view, string theory point of view, that so-called gravitational path integral you're describing is completely overfunded.
Yeah, this is the whole issue, though. It's giving us good answers, which are physically sensible. Yes.
It's just summing of those elements, but it's completely overfunded.
Let me give you this other example just one more time very quickly.
Yeah.
I think Gary and I are the only ones familiar with it, but you can learn
some of us reader makers.
Thanks, Don. I read your papers too. There is a situation which is in fact not irrelevant for black hole physics in which there's some Euclidean gravity effect that is some wild topology-changing thing. There is a regime where the same effect happens, but not because of the gravitational path integral, but instead because of some classical stringy effect. So, you know, it's totally true what you're saying, that there's not a complete story in string theory either, but the idea that there's, with that and also with the longitudinal non-locality stuff, that there's no hint of something new is to me, a strong statement. I'd be glad to hear a no-go, but I haven't.
Maybe
another way of saying it is you're imagining that string theory, the only way string theory gets it would be precise in this language to precisely cancel this. That's not what string theory does.
No, so
it's like thinking about how string theory cures the UV divergences of Einstein's theory. It doesn't do that by, you know, giving some rule
to
each of the counter terms.
The reason I'm sort of maybe biased against thinking it's, there are some examples where the problems I'm talking about can be solved in a way which is a little bit more friendly to this language, and that's why I'm a little bit biased towards thinking it's something like that. That's, I guess, what I'll say. And especially, maybe you'll think differently after what Don and Henry are going to tell us about.
Quickly, are those examples large radius examples with this hierarchy of scales and all that stuff, or?
No. There's some very, very simple examples with not much going on where these problems seem to be solved. What that makes me think is, well, in more complicated examples where you have hierarchies of scales, you have strings, you have everything, why is it, doesn't an analog of something like that work? That seems a bit of a simpler solution.
I tried to give you an example.
Yeah.
Where the same kind of effect happens, but it happens for quite a different reason. Than go ahead, I'm sorry.
Which examples were you referring to?
So the one example would be these periodic orbits, descriptions of semi-classical chaos. Another example would be more recent work done to talk about describing specific members of ensembles, which is what Don and Henry are going to tell us about in a moment. I think maybe I want to let them talk because I want to make a sort of journey. And a lot of the things I wanted to say were just sort of introducing some concepts that might make it a little bit easier to put what they're going to say into context.
Can I just make a comment concerning, I mean, it's not clear to me that you have to say in string theory you need to cancel this contribution because, well, first of all, you don't necessarily know they need to include this other point to begin
with. Yeah, exactly.
You know, you could imagine there's some topological selection rule, and at the end of the day, the only real criteria are things like unitarity. And also, we also know examples, many examples, in fact, even in matrix integral, where, you know, if you're talking about some subtle point that's supposed to produce some non-perturbative correction, but if the perturbative series is not Borel summable, then the choice of the Borel transform contour will dictate how you actually take into account the instant corrections. So, you know, there are many ways one could imagine this thing gets corrected when you...
Yes. You know, yeah, so maybe I'll just end on saying I completely agree. There's many, many ways you could think that the story changes when you're not in the context of an ensemble. There's many ways you can think about it. I think it's interesting that the naive gravity path integral gives us very sensible answers for lots of different quantities. All of these quantities correspond to something like a self-averaging quantity. I think that is a nice hint that the gravity path integral might know a little more than is obvious about these non-ensemble theories, but it's merely a hint, and I don't want to take it too seriously because, like everyone is emphasizing, there's all sorts of modifications that are possible for this story. And hopefully we're going to hear about one in a second.
Okay, let's hear from Henry now.
Relatively brief.
Well, I'm sure there may be some questions. let's see. So, luckily, I've had lots of excellent talks and discussions over the last week or so to set up what I want to say. A lot of this has really been coming from taking recent lessons and just going back to the 80s and looking at some of the old literature and lessons that people learned there. So let's start off. I'm going to think about some boundary conditions for a path integral in ADFs, and this is these are very similar sort of notation things to what Don was talking about on the for the first session, where we have some sources in a Euclidean section or something which creates some state. So I've got some asymptotic ADF boundary, I turn on some sources, so perhaps this is something that creates a bag of gold space-time with some state of matter inside it. It could also be something where I collapse a black hole and evaporate it and project onto some particular state of Hawking radiation. So it's or you can very sort of simple models of end-of-the-world brains in J.T. Garrison, for example, that others have talked about. And I'll design this so that if I sort of take the naive inner product of this thing, computed by just the leading saddle point in the path integral, then this takes two copies of these, glues them together with a J and an I. So there's some space-time, there's some state inside, and I just choose these labels, I and J, such that this is delta IJ. Okay. This is something I can do. And in Don's talk, he was computing, for example, the trace of rho squared to diagnose where the density matrix, as you entangle this in some auxiliary system, this is the sort of thing we talked about in the page curve discussions, and you end up with so there's some label J associated here, this label I associated with this, and we look at space times like this turn out to be relevant. So I'm going to draw this picture in a different way that's sort of suggestive. It's the same picture. And let's think of time running upwards. So what is happening in this process? Well, I start without anything. I then create some state with some bulk, and then this baby universe splits off. So this here is a little closed baby universe that has split off from the space-time where we might live here, and then it's gone, propagated, and it's joined onto some other baby universe. So this immediately gives us a hint that thinking about the physics of closed universes is intimately related to thinking about these sort of Euclidean wormholes and things that join apparently disconnected boundaries of space-time together. So
this was Euclidean or Lorentzian?
It doesn't. Okay, so this is, think of this as a Euclidean picture. Yeah. This is the...
Henry, this is really a universe with two end-of-the-world brains as its boundary in some sense, if you interpreted this INJ as an end-of-the-world brain?
So if it's an end-of-the-world brain, then this would be some I label end of the world brain, some J label end of the world brain. But this could be, maybe Don was talking about some bag of gold that has a smooth origin and just some state of matter fields. So this then looks like just some closed universe with some matter fields in state I over one end of the universe and some matter fields with state J over in the other end of the universe. And so the limit of what this universe is only your imagination, is you.
Well, I'm having some trouble. Yes. Are you claiming that the universe could be topologically closed, like a?
The universe is topologically closed. Yeah.
Wait.
So, and okay. Well, yeah. Yes.
I mean, you wouldn't care if it were compact hyperbolic space. You, by closed, you just mean finite volume.
Boundary. Compact hyperbolic spaces are closed.
Without it doesn't have an asymptotically ADS boundary.
This is the
important thing. There's no place which is, so over here we have asymptotically ADS boundaries, which is a place we'd say this is somewhere we need to fix boundary conditions, and it's got handles I can tune and I can do things. Here there's no asymptotic ADS boundary, so
but you're
no,
not saying it's like a sphere or a circle.
It could be, but no.
Well, not here, it couldn't be.
Here it's not. Well, maybe there's an extra dimension and this isn't a smooth origin or something. It could be. It definitely could be. Let's. I'm going to define. I'm going to use the notation Zij for, and this notation really means this boundary condition here. So it's the boundary condition that would compute some sort of partition function with sources I and j. This is just notation. So let's think about this process. So I've got this HBU is a Hilbert space of closed universes. And this process, I can think of some initial state here. And this initial state is the Hubble-Hawking state. So I've got some amplitude, it's best to think of this as a Euclidean picture, and there's no nothing to create universes in the past, so this is finding the Hubble-Hawking state, and I've got the Hubble-Hawking state in the future, but now I have some non-trivial state of baby universes as an intermediate state. And I've got this state of IJ. And this thing doesn't factorize. Okay, this is so this Zij is I can now think of it as an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of closed universes. So I start with a closed universe, I insert this asymptotically ADS boundary, and I do the path integral to compute the wave function of closed universes in the future of this asymptotic boundary.
Is there really a space-time at that initial and final? It looks like your entire...
There's no space-time,
so it's not a closed universe.
Although, of course, I could have a little bubble that spontaneously gets created. So, okay, one example of a closed universe is nothing whatsoever.
No closed universe.
It's the empty closed universe. And, okay, something that will be very important later is, of course, where I've done this slicing will make a difference. So using different variants or a sort of... I can decide to slice time whichever way I like. So I can choose a time slice that goes like this, and now I really do have a closed universe that was sort of spontaneously created from nothing. And, I don't have a universal notion of time, so... It's simplest to think of this in the Euclidean context. I could have some big signature thing.
Zij is the same thing that's defined on the previous blackboard.
So Zij, okay. Zij is, I want to call this the... It's this boundary condition, where I don't... And I'm being ambivalent as to what fills it in. So I'm calling it this boundary condition. If I were to think of this in ADS-CFT, a year ago, I would have said, if this is a boundary condition, I fill it in with some geometry. It's got some dual geometry, and this the on-chain action of this geometry computes the partition function with some sources, the dual CFT.
Yeah, could you say one more time, why is this like acting as an operator in this matrix element?
That's fine. So it's an operator, the definition of this operator, I have some initial state of closed, so a matrix element of this operator, I have some initial state of closed universes and some final state of closed universes. And the operator is defined as the path integral where I start with my favorite initial state, I finish with my favorite final state, and I do the path integral over all configurations that join the two, but also I have to include this guy.
Now you have Z and Z hat. Are they the same or different?
I've called it a hat to emphasize that this I should think of as an operator, but I don't know if it's clarifying or confusing. and this really does. But, so in any case, it's in this equation, I'm thinking about this as an operator acting on the Hilbert space of bit universes. Okay. And these are not just any old operators. There's, if I have zij and zkl, any two of these operators actually commute. Because I can slice time in anywhere I like. I can decide to insert intermediate states, not here, but I can sort of do something like this. And there's no inherent ordering in these things. So these are commuting operators.
Equals zero.
Sorry?
Equals zero. Equals zero.
Most important piece. Zero, yes. So these are commuting operators. Okay, I have a quantum mechanics, and I have a bunch of commuting operators. What should I do? Okay, and these are, think of them as Hermitian operators, as well, if you like, but that's not important. What I can do is simultaneously diagonalize all of these things. Maybe I should have that up here. So, there are states. So there are orthonormal, I want to say there's an orthonormal basis of states, which I'll call alpha, of this baby universe Hilbert space, which have the defining property that they have some eigenvalues, zij alpha. Okay. So,
Henry, before you construct the whole Hilbert, or, well, diagonalize all the operators, can you say a little bit more about this Hartle-Hawking state, how I should think of that? I think I'm struggling a little bit because of the low dimensionality of this or something, but...
This could be any dimension.
Uh-huh. But you said there's no space-time in the beginning. But normally, I think of the Hartle-Hawking state as something where I do have a space-time.
Okay, yes. So I want to think of the Hartle-Hawking state as just as being the state of universes defined by doing a path integral where I don't insert explicitly any boundary conditions in, say, the Euclidean past. So usually in the cosmological context, we think, okay, let's just focus on one sort of connected component of the universe. It's sort of created by some instanton with an S3, and then it gives us an expanding universe or something. But, of course, I can have many universes, or I can have no universes whatsoever. So...
There are disconnected space-times that start at the bottom slice and end at the top slice. No?
Yeah, so one process that I should... So I've drawn just one process, one configuration in the path integral, but there are, of course, many, many different configurations in the path integral that I haven't drawn that would be there. And they include processes in my Hartle-Hawking state where in the past I have some instanton. So this could be an S3, like in the conventional Hartle-Hawking state, which is created and it propagates up to the final state and is spontaneously destroyed. So I should include this process as part of this amplitude.
And you have many
non-baby
universes. You have to create a baby universe.
You don't have to create a baby universe either. So another process is just the factorized thing. In fact, probably the dominant process here is that I don't create any baby universes. The point is only that there is some non-zero amplitude for creating a baby universe. I have some non-trivial state of baby universes. And summing over those amplitudes is how we're getting these interesting things like the page curve, and so forth.
I'm so sorry, but I'm completely lost. The blackboard is a space-time here, or it's not?
Here is some space-time. The interior.
Yeah, but the board is not.
The void.
The board is the abstract void.
So what does it mean to place these things into particular positions and to say that up here and down there is a Hartle-Hawking state and is there any way of understanding? I mean, I can think of the Hartle-Hawking state the way I understand it as a weight functional. The argument is a metric,
yeah.
And I do a path integral with that metric as the boundary condition, and no other boundaries. I just don't understand how this language translates into what you're doing here.
Okay, so if I wanted to be more careful about it, I would define amplitudes in this baby universe silver space as some set of sort of complete set of boundary conditions for the path integral. So, for example, let's see.
I mean, can you make an analogy to worldview string theory where you have an S matrix and there are these kinds of processes? And I mean, the difference seems to be you have this yes. ADS, but maybe there's a D brain that the strings are all forced to end on or something.
There's some
people
in
Well, I'm asking, I meant that to phrase that as a question. Is there a important technical difference between the two?
There's an even simpler example, which is good old field theory in the first quantized picture, right, where we think about sum over graphs, and you just think about the intrinsic geometry of the graphs, and that's where the geometry is, and outside the graphs, there's nothing.
Right. Yeah, so, okay, we can think about this in string theory. Normally, conventionally, we would have a target space so that we can slice it. So, but, okay, there's no target space here.
So you just don't have the scalar fields or whatever.
So, there's no...
What is the phase space that this is a Hartle-Hawking state of? Or in? What is the analog of all the three metrics?
It's just the space of three metrics.
It is, I think it is the space of three metrics. Yeah. It's just that three metrics need not be connected, and one three metric is intercept.
Can I just repeat what you said in the language that Raphael had to translate briefly?
Yeah.
So Raphael, as you said, Raphael, you're waiting.
Yeah, I'm
okay, you're here. As you said, you think of the Hartle-Hawking state as being a wave function of three metrics created from a no-boundary pass condition. Okay, that has various components, if you will. Let's first note that there will be some component, or there could be a component, where there are no universes created at all. Could be. On Henry's left diagram, on his lower slice, he has drawn the part of the Hartle-Hawking state represented by the zero universe component of the Hartle-Hawking state you understand. The probability to get the empty set for the three geometry. There are, of course, other components, which he described as other processes.
Oh, sorry, you're allowing the arguments to be not just single connected three geometries, but an arbitrary number including zero of connected three geometries?
That is correct. So arbitrary three geometries, not just arbitrary connected three geometries.
So indeed, naively, one description of this Hilbert space, at least naively, is that you take the sort of Hilbert space that you're familiar with of a single universe, and then you just take a Fock space built out of those, which has many.
That's great, but then I would have expected the Hartle-Hawking state to have some support in all... numbers of components. Whereas you said earlier that there's no space-time at all.
Yes.
So I'm confused by that.
Okay, so really there's no boundary condition that has created any universes here. There are processes where I create baby universes, where I create spontaneously create baby universes, and they're possibilities that I'm allowing for. This is one configuration that is consistent with the no boundary initial condition.
And that's specified by our HH?
And this HH is the Hartle-Hawking state. So what this means, the definition of this amplitude, if you like, is just the path integral where I integrate over all configurations with a boundary corresponding to Zij and a boundary corresponding to Zji. I could have had a different state here, which itself maybe has another asymptotically ADS boundary that I think was creating the initial state.
Just to clarify, so I think back in the 80s we might have thought of this as being basically the vacuum for baby universes, the zero baby universe state. Is that it? Are you saying that is what you're doing?
Yeah, so this is another way of saying it, is it's the baby universe vacuum. And in free quantum field theory, the baby universe vacuum, the vacuum is the state of no particles whatsoever. But in interacting quantum field theory, you can spontaneously create positron and electron pairs out of the vacuum.
Yeah, it carries over nicely to this first quantized picture.
Is the reason you're not going to this first quantized thing that you don't want to have to answer the question of nth quantization? Because if you have a target space, you then have to ask if what you do with it and all that, and it gets very even more wild. And
There's the reason that I'm not talking about this. Okay, there's a beautiful paper written by Steve and Andy Strominger from 1988 or something that talks about this in this third quantized language.
Yeah, this is third.
We need to go to third.
Yeah, but you have to ask why.
There's a reason why I'm not using that language, and it's number two. So in the analogy with quantum field theory, it turns out that in the situations we'll be interested in, the effects of the baby universes splitting and joining will be strongly coupled. And in that case, using perturbation theory, so to speak, roughly this third quantized language, is not the most useful way to use it. So I'm describing it in a more abstract way, and we're not going to have to use that third quantized language.
Henry, in the original Hart-Locking paper with their choice of sign, the amplitude for different metrics, for example, in an inflationary potential, came out to be roughly set by the de Sitter entropy. Now, if I started allowing multiple disconnected spacetimes, it would seem that the more spacetimes I allow, the larger the amplitude gets.
Yes.
Is that a sensible setting? I mean, is that what you're saying here, that you have that the Hart-Locking state means that, in fact, I have a divergent amplitude the more components I add?
It means that, yeah, there's a very large number of universes. In fact, the interactions between universes, which are these sorts of processes, maybe universes split and join,
would diverge.
It turns out, and hopefully I'll say this at point number two, that it looks like it diverges, but the fact that there are some very small interactions of splitting and joining processes actually sort of regularizes that.
It's worth reminding Raphael that you're talking about a context where you've already said you want some ADS asymptotics. You might imagine that your closed universe is also the negative cosmological constant. The de Sitter case is interesting to discuss.
Yes.
Okay, I think I understand that coded method.
Yes. And if you don't have to worry about the divergence from closed universes, then you can divide this by the norm of the Hart-Locking state itself, which is you divide out by all closed universes. So we only have to consider the configurations which actually connect to our asymptotic ADS boundaries. So we could discuss that if you worry about that. All right.
You label the Hart-Locking state as the baby universe vacuum. Do you mean as in it has no baby universes, or you mean it has no asymptotic boundaries?
I mean it has no asymptotic boundaries. So it includes amplitude for creating baby universes spontaneously out of the vacuum in this kind of.
Okay. I have a question. It seems natural from your picture that you should allow slicings through the ADS boundary, but you're not doing that.
So we'll talk in a moment about slicings that go through the ADS boundary. Once you do those slicings, that we're talking about a different Hilbert space, because there's a boundary we're putting in by hand. So there's actually the baby universe Hilbert space is not the only interesting bulk Hilbert space. There are other bulk Hilbert spaces where we cut boundaries, and we'll come to those. Good. Fine. Okay, the point of this picture was to show that there's some non-trivial baby universe that's interesting here. In other words, these intermediate states are interesting. What were we saying? Fine, okay, so we have some orthonormal basis of Hilbert spaces. I simultaneously diagonalize these Z operators. When I compute any amplitude, for example, if I were to compute this amplitude not in the Hart-Locking state, but in one of these alpha states, then this thing is just given by the product of the one-point functions. In other words, if I start in one of these alpha states and not in the Hart-Locking state, amplitudes factorize. This problem of ensembles and so forth is not there in these alpha states. to be more explicit about that, if I do compute in the Hardle-Hawking state, I can now insert complete sets of intermediate states here and here and here. And because of the orthonormality, this amplitude that I had over here will be given by the Hardle-Hawking with alpha from the left. I get the same alpha on the right-hand side, so it's the modulus square, times the z alpha ij, z alpha ji, some little alpha. And if I call this thing p alpha, then this amplitude very explicitly is an average of products of amplitudes in the alpha states with some weighting p alpha. In other words, this is an ensemble average. Individual members of the ensemble correspond to individual alpha states. So, and in fact, there's a basis of the Hilbert space of closed universes, which are in one-to-one correspondence with members of the ensemble. Might be important enough to write down. Is that important enough to write down?
Can you say it again?
Alpha states are in one-to-one correspondence with members of the ensemble. And there's a description then of what the individual members of the ensemble are that you could formulate in effective field theory. Non-perturbative effective field theory. What's my notes? That's too long to say. Okay, so let's use this thinking in this context of evaporating black hole. Horizon, create a black hole, I let it evaporate, and maybe from Raphael I'll collect the radiation in some Dyson sphere over here, and I have some density matrix of radiation. Okay, what do I want to say? But over here, there's some slice, so if I consider a Cauchy slice that looks like this, it's not mysterious at all from the point of view of effective field theory why the radiation was mixed. It's mixed because it's entangled with whatever fell into the black hole. In other words, it's mixed with the state of this baby universe. The interior of the black hole has created a baby universe at the last stages of the black hole evaporation. So, what do I want to say? I have some total state psi, and this state of the baby universe I can write as a superposition of alpha states. So, diagonalizing in that basis, I have some psi alpha, state of the radiation, times alpha. And because each psi alpha corresponds to a single member in the ensemble, in fact, quite explicitly, it really is a pure state of the radiation. So this is the radiation system, and this is the baby universe system.
Can you say again what kind of state it is? It's a not an eigenstate of the number of baby universes, or
It is not an eigenstate of the number of baby universes.
And when you do this black hole, calling the singularity of baby universe, you meant it's some state that's a superposition of different numbers of baby universes?
Yes, so it will be a superposition of different numbers of baby universes. So, okay, maybe...
That's you're replacing the singularity with that, is that what...
I'm replacing...
Singularity. The singularity with that, is that what you said?
So I don't think I have to replace the singularity. I could take some Cauchy slice that never goes near the singularity and use the sort of... This gives me a solution to the Wheeler-Witt equation, if you like.
The closed universe, whatever, the baby universe is coming out of the board, sort of, in some sense.
Or
put it on the diagram with the one connected component, but...
for it to be closed, it needs to hit at least the last point.
It needs to hit. So a Cauchy slice for my closed universe runs between this point of final evaporation, which is mysterious to me, but it runs from that point of final evaporation down to the origin, and it need not go anywhere too close to the singularity.
You're saying it's obvious from this picture those are disconnected universes.
I think the fact that the black hole completely evaporates is equivalent to the statement that the interior becomes a closed universe. It becomes a closed universe with perhaps some slightly strange singular point at one end of it.
Are you saying it's not a physical question to ask how many black holes we have in the universe?
How many baby universes?
I mean, you're equating these with baby universes, and you're saying that there's alpha eigenstates, which are sort of everything's diagonal, where you don't know how many baby universes were. It's okay when they were small, but now you're talking about them as being big, and you're equating them with black holes that are evaporating. I would have thought, you know, we can tell, okay, we have this black hole in the lab, and we're going to watch it, and to say that it's in some state which is indeterminate in the number of black holes seems...
It's also Pastor Lorenzen.
I don't think he's saying that. There's a state of baby universes out there in this picture, and this is a picture where you have a transition where maybe you increase the number of baby universes by one. If you radiate one is emitted, you know, they're created in this process. And, you know, so you have all those amplitudes, but then there are different states you could be in for that ensemble, or for the collection of baby universes, and in particular there are these alpha eigenstates where you sort of diagonalize.
The baby universe state alpha is like the final state. You're projecting onto that state somehow.
Yes, I think that's one way to interpret the consequences of
And this, also, when you calculate the entropy of this density matrix, you don't do it in the full Hilbert space, because otherwise you get the contribution from this entanglement, right?
Which density matrix? Well, there are several things you can compute.
That is an entangled. I mean, the state you wrote is an entangled state between radiation and the alpha states.
Yes.
The usual thing that Rita can gives you is not the...
Yeah, so the thing that Rita Kanagi gives us is it seems to be computing the entropy of this state, which is zero, and then it averages over alpha.
Yeah, that's right.
One second comment, and that is, you know, there's this paper by Polchinski and Strominger.
Yeah, I was going to call that one in a moment. Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, basically, they landed on a picture where you have remnants because of this whole question of, you know, how fast this breaking off process can take place. But anyway, I'll let you.
Okay. Well, that's. I wasn't going to mention that bit. But, let's see. Okay.
Sorry. So, I missed when you said the basis for that equation you just wrote, that the state has that form. What is telling you that it doesn't even seem, maybe this is related to Gary's question, but it seems like if I just thought semi-classically about what's happening, I would not have written that state down. So why are you writing that state?
Let's see. So, So the only contentful, if you've agreed that the Hilbert space has this split where there's some closed universes and then some sort of naive Hilbert space, then the only contentful piece of this statement is the fact that this psi alpha is pure. And I'm not even sure that's consequential. This is just a Schmidt decomposition of the.
I see.
By any state like
it's
this,
the basis
I claim the Schmidt decomposition, the alpha basis turns out to be correct.
I think I get it.
So why is that alpha basis?
Because if it's for this reason that I get factorization and unitarity for any process in an alpha basis. I don't want to have to get too much into weeds.
Like the theta vacuum.
Yes, it is a lot like a thief.
The useful word here is to call the alpha basis a set of super selection sectors.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
These are operators that all commute and describe everything you can study from the perspective of this external Hilbert space. So when you have a set of super selection sectors, it's the natural basis to use.
Okay. So an amplitude that's like this, where I have two Z's, is a model for something like a repeated experiment, where I don't just collapse one black hole and collect the radiation and measure it, say, but I do this many, many times. And the fact that these things are factorizing, the fact that these are all simultaneous eigenstates of all of these experiments, tells me that when I do repeated experiments, n experiments, I get an n-fold copy of radiation here. Not the sum over alpha, psi alpha, r, tensor alpha, square root, p alpha. Not this. And this is crucial, because if I do this experiment many, many times, this tells me, this state is the thing that I would naively expect if I don't have any splitting and joining processes. And it gives me n copies of Hawking's thermal mixed state of the radiation. This, when I trace out alpha, gives me n states. Each of them on their own gives me Hawking state, a thermal state, but they're all correlated. They're correlated in such a way that they are a classical mixture of many copies of the same pure state. So I have information loss in the sense that a mixed state comes out if I start with a Hubble-Hawking state, but it's not an information loss in a terribly meaningful way. Because if I try to do an experiment, maybe I evaporate two black holes, collect the Hawking radiation for both, and then measure a swap operator that compares the two. This is a very good test to distinguish a mixed state from a pure state. That experiment would tell me it's a pure state.
Sorry, Henry, what is a pure state? I mean, the state of the N systems together is a mixed state, you just said, right?
The state of the N systems together, so this gives me a classical mixture of N copies of the same pure state.
Yes, which is also called
this a mixed state. This gives me N copies of a classical mixture.
No, I'm just discussing the one that you said is the actual case.
Yeah.
That is a mixed state since it's a mixture.
I
don't care if there's a mixed state of N copies, all of which have the same, I mean,
yeah, I don't understand you used the word classical and the difference between mixed and mixture.
So
classical. So
let's trace out the baby universes, because I can't see them. I can't observe them. What this gives me is a state like this.
Yeah, that's just called a mixed state. I mean, we can call it classical mixture, but that means the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Except it's, okay, it's a convex combination of. It's a mixed state that I can describe as a probability distribution of pure states.
It's a separable mixed state. That's what
separable it is. State, yeah. So the fact that these p alphas are non-negative integers has content. It tells me that I can model this mixed state as a classical ensemble.
These psi alphas are orthogonal?
No.
Was that not required for your statement? It says a mixture.
And the exponent, can you draw brackets that tell us what the exponent applies to in your top line?
Here.
Yeah, does that exponent apply to the P's or not?
This does not apply to the P's. These are my brackets.
Yeah, okay, but I want to draw another one. I want to draw a square bracket after the P, and then at the very end, after everything else. Is that correct?
That's, yep.
Okay.
He's trying to get clarity.
Clarity is good.
Henry, so the psi alphas are not orthogonal. That's what you said.
No, so the psi alphas are to be interpreted as columns of the S matrix in each member of the ensemble. They need not be.
But can I rewrite this state as a density operator?
Which state?
The one you wrote at the top right.
This is a density operator. Yeah.
Good.
And then so therefore I can write it in some way where it's diagonalized. It really is a mixed state.
Right? This really is a mixed state. If you compute the probability, you get the Shannon entropy of, or compute the entropy, you get the Shannon entropy of the piece.
That wasn't obvious to me anymore now that you said that the psi alphas are not orthogonal.
Okay.
It's still true.
It's still true. It just so happens to be true.
No, it's always true.
Always true? No, I mean, if the psi alphas are all the same, for example, then I clearly don't get, the Shannon entropy of the p alphas. So it's clearly not always true.
This is not crucial. But the main point is that this state is mixed, but if you were to try to observe it, this is a model of a repeated experiment, any experiment that you do to try to demonstrate that this is mixed would tell you that it's pure. Another way of saying it is that when I do this experiment, I learn something about the state of the baby universes, or I decohere in the alpha basis.
Right.
Okay. My brain ends up in one term of this sum.
Because we are in the psi alphas.
We are in the psi alphas, yes. If we live in the bunk, so to speak.
Could you say just one more time why it was not observable, the information loss was not observable?
It's because when I do my experiment many, many times, I can do this experiment so many times that I can really work out the density matrix of the radiation that came out. And but because, let's see. Each time
insight from the 80s, when we talked about this, you can perform repeated experiments. So we do have information loss, but the amount of information loss sort of decreases with each repeated experiment, and you can think of that as information loss associated with determining which member of the alpha ensemble you're living in.
Yes.
And once you've determined it, then there's no more information.
Yeah.
Compared to the initial state, you've lost information.
Yeah. So it's equivalent to the situation in cosmology where
the loss of information is just simply ignoring the values of the couplings, right?
It's associated with the uncertainty in which going from a state where it's associated with the distribution of couplings.
I mean, we normally don't say that when we prepare a glass of water we lose information because we don't know the precise value of alpha. For
example. No, but if you could set the example we used to use is is the fine structure constant, the fine structure constant could be in the superposition of 1 over 136 plus 1 over 137. And then, you can set up an ensemble like this, and then you ask,
it's a different context when you're discussing the universe in your cosmological sense.
No,
it's the same. So if I look at a real black hole in the universe, alpha is going to change. Depending on which black hole I look at.
In this approximation, you've got the superposition of alphas, which represents the whole state. But then you perform repeated experiments, and you're measuring, and you're determining more precisely what alphas, you see. It's like a collapse of the wave function, although that's, I agree, you probably have it.
Alpha is not dependent on the black hole.
I think there's a simpler operation.
Alpha does not depend on the black hole. The alphas are super selection sectors, they're fixed.
Of the whole.
There's a set of closed universes out there in the void. They're spaceless and timeless, and they can choose at any moment to exchange with the interior of a black hole, and that's what's going on.
Since you raised the theta vacuum question, it's like starting in an N vacuum and starting to make measurements, and then ultimately you'll find the result.
What bothers me here is that the black holes are localized out there. You're going to have a black hole.
Yes.
Megaparsecs or another one.
The baby universes are not. The baby universe joins distant black holes and has an amplitude to join distant black holes that is independent of the distance between them asymptotically.
It has an amplitude to join black holes that live in different asymptotic universes. You could have this ADS box and this ADS box, and they refer to the same baby universes for controlling the output.
This process involves.
But coming back to the
written out in the alpha. I mean, we'd like a essentially to be able to have a function that says alpha.
Right, but I think that's something that alpha. I mean, just a comment on something that Henry already said. So there is an operational way to test whether black hole is, whether it's unitary or not, without knowing alpha, which is to measure the swap operator. You do it twice, you
measure
the swap operator. So you do the experiment twice, and then you check whether you get the same answer basically in both experiments. And this is some experiment you only need to do once, or at least twice. You have to create two black holes, you do the experiment, and you check. And this will give you, you could check that, and that check is independent of alpha. So you don't need to know alpha to know whether the process was unitary.
Yeah, there's another way to do it, which is just to look at the von Neumann entropy, with sequential measurements, and it's declining. You're losing less information.
The nice thing about this swap operator is this is an operator. It's something you can actually measure and do, and so on.
Henry? Normally, once we measure a coupling constant, we sort of move on and don't say that, we once used to be ignorant of it. Is there some description of this whole thing where we can just say, well, let's suppose that we've already measured the alphas. Do I have to keep this whole baggage of all the other alphas to do a calculation?
There's an analogy in cosmology here, which is that perhaps we know what the theory, string theory is maybe the correct description of our universe and is a single theory, but we can't use it for predictions because we don't know very much about the initial state of the universe. And when we observe the CMB, we're learning something about the initial state of the universe, and then we'll eventually go, aha, we know the theory, it involves this dynamics and this initial condition. And that may or may not be there. And these alphas become, in ADS-CFT, we're used to not having to worry about the initial condition. All I'm telling you is that for a unitary description, you need a theory of the initial conditions as well, and a specific sort of theory.
But again, that this is also an important point of this discussion. That if once you have measured the alphas, it's like measuring the coupling constants. Okay, now they are what they are. And then the question is, what does the evolution look like? And once you've measured that. And the question is, in particular, is it unitary? When you describe black hole formation and evaporation, and how do you understand that it's unitary? Now that you're in this alpha eigenstate, so you don't have these effective transitions.
Yes,
that's fine. Gary. If you had a black hole and you let it evaporate down to maybe a tenth of its original mass, so it's way past the page time, yep. But then start feeding it or put it in a box and so it stabilizes and doesn't evaporate away, would this analysis apply? Would you still want to equate that some baby universe, this? It doesn't look like a baby universe anymore, and nevertheless you have the same information puzzle that, we'd like to understand.
Indeed. It doesn't, I can't draw this same picture where there's a clean separation of the baby universe and so forth, but I could still say that in the distant past, here's my experiment, in the distant past I really create an alpha vacuum which populates the space of closed universes in some non-trivial way, and when my black hole gets past the page time, which is point two, then the amplitude for interactions with the baby universes for these sorts of splittings and joinings becomes crucially important for the description.
That's the second part.
Let's see.
Did you do this point one?
Sorry?
I think you've done point one?
I think I've done point one. Yes. point two. I didn't prime Gary to ask me that question, but it was perfect. I wish I had. Let's see.
So the conclusion I think I want to draw from what you said seems to be different than the conclusion Raphael drew yesterday. Do the two of you agree with that or not?
There's an underlying problem here, which is that in something like N equals 4 Supiang-Mills,
I don't care about n equals 4 c.
I care about evaporating black holes. And is the Hawking radiation going to look pure to me, who just goes and does the measurements, or not?
This tells you that that it's going to look pure. And I think that's, there may be another way in which it can be pure. But this is really just taking the gravitational path integral very seriously. And if you take it seriously and include the effects of splitting and joining baby universes, you land on a prediction for experiment, which is that you will verify a pure state.
And Raphael, do you agree with that?
I have no idea, because I don't think we really understand that yet.
And yesterday you said the answer to that question was no, that the experiment will see a mixed state of Hawking radiation.
I think in the setting that I study, an outside observer would see a mixed state. And I don't understand how that's related to this in a good enough way to answer your question.
Yeah. So I think that relied on having the idea of a single CFD joule. I think, as I understand,
the conflict arose when you had a single CFD tool. Yeah.
So it's a conclusion that arises from that this analysis seems to suggest that there is not a single CFD joule. There is an ensemble of joules which are labeled by this initial state of the universe. So it's this is an excellent question.
How many alpha parameters are there?
How many alpha? Let's see, which of those questions should I address first? we don't know how many alpha parameters there are. There are two extreme possibilities. So one possibility, we're back on one again, Don. One possibility is that the dimension of the Hilbert space of baby universes is one. There is only one state of baby universes, and because of section 2, some dynamics we don't know about, that if we were to do this in type 2B string theory, we would discover that there really is a unique state of the baby of closed universes. And this is not ruled out. In which case, there is one alpha parameter. And we have physics. Yeah. But it's not clear how to reconcile that at this point with this semi-classical description of the page curve and so forth.
So this would be like the final state idea, the original one?
Perhaps. We may end up just going back a few years and opening our box of possibilities.
I mean, this would be like that possibility.
I missed one.
Yes.
Unique state.
So is it accurate or? Is it accurate or not that this alpha ket is then just a bookkeeping device to keep track of the disorder? The various members of the ensemble, is that what this alpha ket is?
From the boundary point of view, if you like, but alpha is some specific state of closed universes, and if you want to, you can describe bulk physics. There is a single Hilbert space, and if you want to describe the bulk physics appropriate to that ensemble, then it's telling you that that's the initial state. It's some specific state. It's got some details that are in the amplitudes of different closed universes, and if you were very, very smart and you could do a calculation of, do Hawking's calculation, but including this particular, very specific, very special population of closed universes, you would get a pure state and predict what that state is. But that leads me to the other possibility, which is the opposite extreme to this, which is that the number of alpha parameters is basically just the number of everything that's compatible with unitarity. And that the alpha parameters are just basically the only way to write down alpha is to have a giant database that tells you what the S matrix is for every possible kind of black hole. That's really bad for physics. In some way.
In this toy model, do you have an alpha for every ij?
No. So the ijs are... it may be that there's... So there's the ijs may not be independent. They may be related to one another by some modular invariance or whatever. Unitarity constraints.
Countable.
But the ij, there's a countable dense set of them. Yeah. which means the Hilbert space is separable. But yeah, there's a...
I think, just to come back to the question that Mark's raised, I mean, if you're going to say that observers see a pure state coming out, then of course something has to resolve the Amps type contradiction, and presumably that would have to be some kind of ER equals EPR or similar identification of Hilbert spaces or operators inside and out. And in this case, the interior would have to come from whatever's sitting on this Dyson sphere. Is that something that you can see how that arises in the calculation?
There's a suggestion that is very exciting, which I think needs more following up, is the fact that if you just include a very large population of baby universes with some amplitudes to join with the interior of the black hole, some topology changing process with the right kind of interior state, the right kind of state of closed universes, then that would give you pure radiation. Understanding the details of that, and this I think is similar in spirit to Steve's question, is extremely interesting.
The Dyson sphere has to enter directly into the calculation because that's where the purification of the outgoing Hawking particles is. So, for example, the calculation would have to be sensitive to whether or not you perform some complicated operation on the information on the Dyson sphere that would allow you to perform the Amps experiment. So some signal of sensitivity to that would have to be present.
I don't think so. I think once you've escaped from the black hole, you can describe everything else using conventional quantum physics. You are arguing that your Dyson sphere you could build using descriptions with conventional...
No, I don't care about the Dyson sphere itself. I care about the quantum information on it after the page time. And I care about the fact that I can use that to distill some bit that I can fall in. And in that case, I can't have a smooth horizon. So whether or not there's a smooth horizon has to... You know, it's the usual stories about all the approaches to the firewall problem. There has to be some sensitivity to, you know, those cases where we know that you can't get rid of the firewall, but we know there has to be an excitation at the horizon because the Amps argument still applies. Like when you've distilled some purification from the Dyson sphere. I'm just wondering, you know, whether this starts giving us a hint of how to construct a consistent theory that does all these things for us.
One of your three interior Hawking photons falls into a wormhole and emerges as an exterior.
Well, again, these things have to be sensitive. Whether or not you can reconstruct the vacuum of the horizon has to be sensitive, for example, to whether or not you perform some complicated operation that distills, you know, logical qubits in the Hawking radiation into physical qubits.
So, although we're running out of time, I'd like to suggest that I actually think we're still short a couple of critical elements in the presentation to allow us to discuss the answer to the question that Raphael was asking. So it may need to wait for a few
minutes. This is good fodder for discussion over the next 3 months or whatever. But maybe I'll just say one more thing in answer to Steve's question, is we have one nice example, which is JT gravity. And in that case, the list of an alpha state, to specify it, there is no shortcut. You have to tell me every single energy of every single state in the ensemble. It's completely structureless.
Is that equivalent to telling you the J tensor in JT gravity?
In SYK.
SYK has more structure and there's less information in there.
Okay, sorry.
Okay. What do we want to say? Okay. So, I promised Tom at the start that I would talk about Hilbert spaces with some boundary. So let's put about, we'll create some state like at the beginning with some source I, and now we'll say that in the past we started in some alpha state, for example, or we could be more general state. And the claim is that this Hilbert space of all possibilities with a boundary, I can write as a direct sum over all the alpha parameters of Hilbert spaces associated to each alpha parameter. And let's see. And now I have the possibilities that there's some baby universe, there's some universe that's part of this alpha state, and there's a process that can make this universe join with my sort of asymptotically ADS universe. And for this, it means that some state that I naively create So psi I alpha here is defined as the state where I begin, not in the Hubble-Hawking state, but in the alpha state, and I add in this boundary. These two states, because of these kind of processes, are not orthogonal. And not only that, but these non-orthogonalities are not just sort of random small parameters. They're small, they're non-perturbatively small, but the number of I labels is very, very large, and there's a conspiracy among these overlaps. And the conspiracy among these overlaps means that the dimension of the Hilbert space of really linearly independent states is much smaller than I would have naively expected. So one way of saying is it is that the entropy as you'd measure in perturbative effective field theory, which is basically the log of the number of these I parameters, and it's roughly the sort of number of states I think that I can fit inside an old black hole, for example, potentially very, very large. It can be much bigger than actually the true entropy, which might be, say, Beckett-Hawking entropy in the context of a black hole, which is giving us the true dimension of the Hilbert space. So these small overlaps conspire to massively truncate the Hilbert space. And we can think of this as being like coming from some sort of gauge symmetry. So let's see. So the true Hilbert space is like a Hilbert space of effective field theory of all these different states, except I throw away all the null states. So there are some states in here that are linear combinations of these psi I alphas that happen to vanish. Some very complicated linear combinations. So I have to truncate by these null states. So this is like Gupta-Bleuler quantization, where you throw out all the null states. So the question then is, what is this gauge symmetry? And this gauge symmetry basically just arises from diffeomorphism invariants, as it's familiar. More specifically, it arises from the fact that there's some choice that we can make when we describe the Hilbert space of universes, which is when we decide to time slice. So whether there's one universe or two universes here is not a gauge invariant notion. There's no gauge invariant operator that measures the number of kinetic components of universes, because they can split and join. I have two here, I have one here, but this is just a choice of slice. And we can actually show that this is always true, that the actual dimension of the Hilbert space is really bounded by the Beckenstein-Hawking entropy if you start in an alpha vacuum.
So which Beckenstein-Hawking entropy are you talking about? At the beginning or the end? Is it defined?
So it's
time pivot.
What we can show, for example, is that if you take this Hilbert space of all the states with some specific average energy, then the dimension of that Hilbert space is bounded by the exponential of the thermodynamic entropy for the corresponding temperature.
So when you describe the gauge invariance this way, there's an analogous question when you come back to the example of the toy model for all of this, which is just first quantized particles, which you think of in a similar picture. And there you can slice things a different way. And what would you say the gauge invariance is that the corresponding gauge invariance there in that picture?
So in fact, first quantized quantum field theory is an example of this. But when we usually discuss the Hilbert space of quantum field theory, there's an extra ingredient there, which is target space, and we slice somewhere specific in target space. And in that case, it's not identical, but there is a diffeomorphism invariance that lives on the world line of any particular particles. I'm not sure. Time reparameterization on the world lines.
You don't get really a new gauge symmetry in field theory from that, per se, do you? I'm trying to think of what that.
No, but it's theory. But this is like trying to. It's like trying to do very, very strongly coupled field theory using Fock space. And when strong coupling effects become very important, that Fock space is not very useful, and the actual Hilbert space may not be.
Okay. Are you saying the gauge invariance on one sense?
What is the null space?
So the null space is the set of is the sets of linear combinations of these sorts of states that naively look like distinct states in effective field theory, but are in fact the same state because they're related by a sort of non-perturbative Wheeler-DeWitt equation that involves interactions between the two universes.
Say again?
I'll be more explicit than that.
You say that again?
Okay. I'll... Because of the splitting and joining, you get relations that look like this. Specifically, this means that if I were to take any one of these basis states and compute the overlap, or if I were to compute the norm of this state, then because of splitting and joining and something of a conspiracy, I would discover that this vanishes. And the fact that one state and another state that look naively different can be the same is, in the end, down to this invariance of time slice.
We can just emphasize that if we had, say, scalar field theory in four dimensions, we could rewrite it in a first quantized framework and describe the calculation of amplitudes that way, and we'd have this similar splicing choice that we could make. But it's not really clear we get a new symmetry from that. What's the envelope?
So, yeah, the symmetry there is basically a different variance on the wild lines. This description is, in some sense, is a little artificial, because the fact that there's some kind of effective field theory Hilbert space is because you're trying to use a sort of weak coupling or perturbative description that's not really...
Even if it was strongly coupled... Question. Are you saying some new symmetry emerges, say, in the strongly coupled limit?
Two quick comments. Okay. One is that if you're talking about slicing a random Feynman diagram in a funny way, you can do that and you have things we call virtual particles, but we all know virtual particles aren't real. That's some vague analogy with the gate symmetry. More important comment, as you say, there's no null space in that context. I think one of the things that happens is in scattering theory in flat space, the target space is non-compact. Things really do go off to minus infinity, and they separate well, and there's no interactions back at minus infinity. That doesn't happen here. It's more
there is an analog here.
Why can't you do quantum field theory in a finite?
It's more like quantum field theory in a finite box. Yeah. And in that case, I don't know, for a strong interaction field theory, there's some Hilbert space, and it's not, I don't even know how to write it in terms of particles in that context.
It's not clear the target space is compact, because part of that target space is the values of fields on the individual universes, and that there can be certainly non-compact situations there. And in fact, we use that as one way of thinking about time in this third quantized approach.
But there's no decoupling direction.
They go to finite values, though, at ADS boundaries. The scalar fields don't run off to minus infinity.
You can't define in-states and out-states of baby universes where they don't interact anymore.
It depends on yourself.
Anyway, you calculate this and model as an degenerate.
Yeah. So, an example of this is in JT gravity, the naive Hilbert space, if we took one universe, then there's a single number that describes the wave function of the universe. It's a wave function of the length of the universe, how far it is around, that you can describe in some equation variant way. These are the solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation that have been worked out by several people. And so naively, you would think that the Hilbert space is like a Fock space, is like a symmetric product of L2 or something. It's a Fock space built out of just L2 or based on positive values of length, I suppose. So, the true Hilbert space has some very special properties. In particular, each member of the ensemble picks out a theory with a discrete spectrum, with a discrete energy spectrum. It's a matrix model with all the partition functions have a discrete energy spectrum, which is something extremely special. And the fact that you get this special property represents a massive truncation of this. I'd like to work this out more explicitly. There's a very sort of simple toy model that we have where this is where something analogous happens, where you can see this very explicitly. The naive Hilbert space as a Fock space built out of all the different universes you can have is not a good approximation to the actual non-perturbative description, including splitting and joining.
But can you see the explicit cancellations according to the negative?
In our toy model, then you can see things extremely explicitly. So in that example, we only have a single type of operator, a Z operator, that just says there's some asymptotic boundary, and it's a topological model, doesn't have any other structure. Naively, this Z operator would have a spectrum that consists of the entire real line. So the Hilbert space would be L2, which is okay. In the non-perturbative thing that we can solve, the spectrum of the Z operator is some non-negative integers. So it means that the Hilbert space has been massively truncated. I think I've exhausted Don's time. The very last comment then is that is when these effects are important. These effects are important when you have something like this that happens, which is that there's a violation of some entropy bound. What this tells you is that, roughly speaking, the amplitude for joining and splitting with baby universes scales exponentially roughly with the area over 4G, something like that. But the number of different universes that you can join or split with depends on this sort of naive Hilbert space, roughly speaking. So there's this phase space, there's this sort of phase space enhancement that means that these sorts of non-perturbative wormhole effects, where splitting and joining become important at leading order, happens precisely when you have violations of entropy bounds, precisely in the sort of situations of the interiors of black holes after page time.
So Don has requested 60 seconds with no interruptions, and then we will thank everyone and thank you so much. So
I'm hoping that with 60 seconds and no interruptions, I can do two things. We'll see if I can do it. One is to sort of tidy things up very slightly, and the other is to set the stage for more productive discussion in the future. Going back to my comments from the other day, I said one of the exciting things about replica wormholes was that it's a story that is apparently about the gravitational path interval, so perhaps we can dissect it and find out what's really happening. This is sociometric machinery for doing that. The same configurations appear in this baby universe story as in the replica wormholes. So by going through it, thinking about alpha vacua, thinking of alpha sectors, thinking about the Ohlers, rest of what we learned from Coleman, Giddings, and Strominger, one hopes to be able to say, in some sense, what happens in a member of the ensemble. Comment one. Comment two. One of the things we learned from Coleman and Giddings and Strominger, we didn't have time to review here, is that these wormholes can be thought of as, in some sense, inducing new interactions or shuffling the coupling constants. Since I only have less than 60 seconds, in the 80s, people were thinking about, had sort of assumed that narrow wormholes of Planck cross-section would dominate the story. And as a result, it was a shuffling of local coupling constants. But right now we're talking about these replica wormholes. The mouth of a replica wormhole is the quantum extremal surface outside a black hole. It's big. So the natural things that are induced are large non-local interactions on the scale of your black hole horizon. Third comment. The new ingredient that Henry just mentioned, which is the same degeneracy that Jin Ben mentioned the other day, okay, I personally believe is also key to discussing questions like what Raphael wanted to ask about what happens. If there's a new gauge symmetry you didn't know about...
But he was just saying it was the old gauge symmetry.
It's an extension of the old gauge symmetry. It's like Diffeo invariance, but it has more consequences than you realize. What it means is there are many states that you would have naively thought are physically distinct and represent distinct outcomes of physical experiments, and yet they differ by null states. And so I can use the words that they're gauge equivalent. And I will stop by saying that I think this is a very important element
to any discussion of trying to understand what happens in old black holes inside. Now it's up to you.
It's not a consequence. It's not something that exists in any Diffie.
It comes from a natural slicing invariance. It's not technically a diffeomorphism, because if I have
slicing,
you know, in the sense of standard GR, if I had this as a Euclidean spacetime and I look at this as a surface, I can't move this Cauchy surface to this one by a diffeomorphism. Okay. So there's a question of what you want to call it. All right. But it's certainly
locally a diffeomorphism.
What's that?
Locally it's a diffeomorphism.
Locally it's a diffeomorphism. Well, except when you come down and do something funny here. Okay.
Yeah, but that's something funny there that you can bring a problem.
You know, what can I say? At the end, what you do is compute the path integral, hopefully correctly. In our case, hopefully correctly. In the models, one thinks one does it correctly by going to the Euclidean signature, and one finds this degeneracy. And the rest is words. Okay. I like the words that Henry gave, that it's a sort of extension of Diffeo invariance, and we can talk more about that, and Ted asked a question and wants to ask one again about the Weir-DeWitt equation. Okay, it all sounds good. I don't know if I'm allowed to take questions or not, because I promised that I was going to sit, talk 60 seconds and stop.
I think we're going to adjourn and have lunch now.